I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University here in Fremantle. Welcome back, Martin.
Fantastic to be here.
I should remind all of our regular listeners, but also the many others who I'm sure will be tuning into this special edition of View from the Roundhouse to hear Martin talk about the astounding election result in the state by-election for the seat of Secret Harbour. That Martin Drum is the Executive Dean for the Faculty of Arts, Sciences, Law and Business at Notre Dame and Professor of Politics and International Relations there. And of course he knows Fremantle well, and he knows the state scene well. Martin, it really was a turn up, wasn't it? This big win on the weekend. But you weren't surprised, because as I've told our regular listeners, you confidently predicted this outcome in the podcast last Friday, and you explained your reasons why. But all that aside, we are still surprised in what happened.
No, I wasn't. Just to reiterate a couple of reasons why you could see this coming. There's been consistent polling across the country that show that One Nation is running in the low, mid, sometimes high 20%. I think even they've tipped over 30 in one or two polls. So that we know that they're polling well. We know it's consistent. In Western Australia, they polled at 4% only a year ago. They're now polling at 21% in the latest poll. So you can do your sums. That's around about a magnitude of five times what they polled last time. We also knew that Secret Harbour was one of the highest polling electorates for One Nation last year at 8.4%. So if you extrapolate that and you get it, you were to multiply that by around about 5%, that gives them a primary of about 40%. And although they finished at about 39.1, in a field of 16 candidates with both Labor and Liberal running, you're getting a primary of around about 39, 40%, you're home and host. Their preference flows weren't great, but they were comfortably enough to get them over the line. So I knew just from consistent polling that this was not a surprise. The other thing we know, Michael, is we know that at by-elections, minor parties do better than normal. And there's a very good reason for that, because people often protest vote. They're often frustrated or annoyed. They know that they're not voting for who the government is, so that they could spray their votes accordingly. And I think that they wanted to give the government and perhaps governments, so federal and state, a kick in the pants, which they certainly did. So the message is certainly being delivered there. I do want to say, Michael, that's not necessarily an indication they'll vote the same way at a state or general election.
Well, Martin, you and I, View from the Roundhouse, for some time now have been tracking the rise and rise of One Nation in the polls, and it looked, as you say, that they were a train that was coming. They weren't being, run off to the side. They weren't suddenly coming to a halt. And they, however you look at it, this is a momentous victory in Secret Harbour. I mean, it's a 30% plus swing, flipping an 11% Labor seat and giving them their first lower house win in the state of Western Australia. I mean, I don't know, don't worry about what the rest of the country's thinking, but I have a sense of what they're thinking. This is a big deal, Matt. I don't think you can just explain it away by saying it's a by-election and that it can't be replicated and couldn't happen in Cottesloe.
I don't know if it'll happen in Cottesloe, but I think it may happen in other places. How about we say that? So there's a couple of interesting points there. The overall and consistent polling across the board suggests that One Nation's rising, and that's now been shown in Farrer, the Farrer by-election. It's been shown in the South Australian election and here. So you've got a fair body of work that we're starting to see. I think Victoria will be especially interesting coming up later this year. That's probably the biggest test for One Nation, I'd say. But there are some characteristics that are really interesting about Secret Harbour. We previously focused a lot on the loss of the coalition vote to One Nation, and I still think that's a really material thing. And if you look at the highest polling electorates last year in the state level, Central Wheatbelt was top, and there's a number of other regional electorates that also feature prominently. But alongside regional electorates is outer metropolitan electorates, Michael. And they're the ones that Labor holds in Western Australia and also the ones that Labor holds federally, in many cases. And they're the second target area for One Nation. So there's some really interesting target there. I might talk, I know that many of your voters are interested in the relate who's voting for One Nation. I had a master's research project I supervised, which focused on income and One Nation. And what it showed is that as income declined, the One Nation vote went up. So low SES voters were voting more for One Nation, with two major exceptions, Michael. One, Indigenous, they're not voting One Nation. And two, language spoken at home other than English. So that's the second outlier. So if you're talking about lower income, fairly not, I don't want to use the word monoculture, that's Pauline Hanson's word, but less diverse electorates, they're the ones that I think they're more susceptible to One Nation vote.
Well, I mean, we do have to ask the question about Secret Harbour. I commented last time I came through there last week. It seems to me that it's a classic suburban, leave aside the description of outer suburban electorate. It's right by the beach. It doesn't seem to be particularly impoverished. I take what you say about the economic analysis one can make of the voters and where they stand. But why do you think they did abandon them in this Labor stronghold of it's been with Labor since the 80s?
I think there's a number of things here. I think if you look at, and there has been some analysis also done more recently by focus groups on One Nation voters. What it shows is they're generally frustrated, obviously frustrated about immigration, but that's because it links to a series of economic issues that make them unhappy. So if you can't find a house to live, then you're looking to understand why. And if everything is becoming more expensive, you're looking to understand why. And the simple argument around immigration is that the sheer number of people we have drives housing prices up, and the sheer number of people we have drives the price of goods and services up. That's the simple argument. And that's a fairly easy argument to make. I think it's actually flawed for a number of reasons when you drill down. Mainly, there's a lot of good reasons. International students, which have been targeted, they live in residential colleges all of the time. They also, where they live in private accommodation, they live in larger numbers. So they're not having the impact that people think they are having on housing. And that's true of generally a bit more true of migrants generally about housing. The other thing is migrant, the biggest single intake in immigration is skilled immigration, and they're the skills that we need to build houses and to provide other essential goods and services that people are complaining about. So there's actually a very complex relationship between immigration and the price, the cost of living that people are talking about. Nevertheless, it's a very seductive argument, I would say, for people that are frustrated and angry about these matters. So I think economic anxiety is generally a key issue. Over a period of time, also, our main political parties have spent a lot of time running down each other, and fierce competition's normal in politics, of course. But I think there's also a feeling of political malaise that exists in the community and a sense of frustration that politicians are not listening enough to what people need.
Which
I think that's the other element.
then sort of brings you to the question, were there any real important local issues in Secret Harbour that had the voters going One Nation way? There was the candidate, Lude Hertogen, is only been in the West about 3 years. He lives in the electorate, has a business in the electorate. Along the way, they tried to find some local issues, didn't have enough red bins being put out, apparently. There was a question about the new railway station on the Mandurah to Perth line not being built quickly enough, but they didn't sound like the most critical issues of all time. It seems, as you say, that it comes back to this very broad, hard to pin down economic issue and the cause of it.
Yeah, normally in by-elections, local issues do play a significant role. We saw them come up a few times, the ones you talked about, the Carnarp rain, train station, which hasn't been built despite being promised a number of times, and local services. But I would say if I look, you've got to look at what people are campaigning about and the volume of campaigning to understand this. And if you look at what One Nation they're campaigning about, they're campaigning mostly about those broader issues. So that's what led me to think that it's about the broader anxiety and frustration and disconnect, I think, that's driving this rather than local issues or even local candidates on this occasion. So again, Georgia Tree, who was the Labor candidate, not living anywhere near the electorate, that was said to be a big issue. That can be an issue in by-elections. Just not convinced that on this occasion that was the chief factor in the outcome.
It is interesting about this move away from the major parties, and in this case, the state Labor government. It's a resource-orientated government. You'd think that might appeal to a number of the people in an electorate like Secret Harbour. It's trying to boost economic performance, income, generally wealth, and Georgia Tree. It seems to, whilst having worked for Madeleine King, I think, as a political staffer. Then's working as an advocate within Woodside, who's sort of liberally hated by the conservation movement in Western Australia, and yet people are sort of put off by that. Do we see the Greens getting a commensurate uptake?
So that was an interesting one, and I'd heard that bandied about that perhaps her being part of the gas industry would work against her and undermine her vote. But if you thought that that would be the case, that would where would they go? They would naturally go and vote for the Greens, wouldn't they? But the Green vote went backwards, so you can't really find evidence that that was a key factor either. Otherwise, you'd expect the Green vote to rise. So that's why, again, I'm not entirely convinced that that was the key factor.
Martin, I, as you know, just haven't been quite prepared to give up the effect of a One Nation victory on the rest of West Australian seats, both state and federal. Particularly when you consider at the last state and federal election in Perth, an independent candidate, community candidate Kate Hewlett, nearly knocked off the sitting state member and cabinet minister Simone McGuirk in Fremantle, and then. To great surprise, went pretty close against Josh Wilson, the federal member for Fremantle, who's also an assistant minister in the Albanese government. Obviously, something's going on, and we've talked about that. But is that sense of walking away from the major parties path being translated here, if you like, into the One Nation victory?
Very interesting observation that even though the Kate Hewlett campaign was very different, I would say, to the One Nation campaign and the issues she was actually campaigning on, climate and the like, were very different to One Nation. I think there is some common sense of frustration with the major parties that both picked up on, and that was certainly evident in Fremantle at both the state and the federal electorates elections, where she did very, very well. So I think that's probably the commonality. And if you're looking at the commonality between Cottesloe and Secret Harbour, there's probably frustrated people. And there was a big independent vote in Cottesloe as well at the last election. But I would just wouldn't think that those people, either in Fremantle or Cottesloe, would be going for One Nation in large numbers.
Well, there's a good number of people though who are saying no one can feel safe in their seat, including all Labor candidates, Martin, right across the board.
I'm not getting ahead of I don't think we should get ahead of ourselves that far. I think that there are particular electorates in the outer metropolitan area of Perth, though, that are susceptible. And I'll name a few Labor ones. I'll name a few. Mandurah certainly is. So that had a high One Nation vote last time round. Murray Wellington, Armidale, Baldivis, Darling Range, Butler. These are the types of outer metropolitan electorates that could certainly be in the firing line for One Nation. And if you had One Nation peeling off half a dozen to a dozen seats. Bear in mind the Liberals only have six seats at the moment. Pair off that number of seats, that could make for a very dynamic and fluid election. But it is a fair way away at state level. We're not getting an election until 2029, so a lot can happen between now and then.
Well, I'm sure Labor members just the same will have heard what Daniel Pastorelli said just a couple of days ago. He's a newly placed cabinet minister in the Cook government, a long-time advisor, you might say, to the former Premier Mark McGowan, and a sort of sane, experienced Labor observer saying no one should take their seat for granted. And I guess you have to if you're Liberal or Labor or any of the other parties. Proceed on that basis, just like the Fremantle Dockers cannot assume they're going to beat Hawthorn tomorrow night, but of course they will. Martin, what about the Liberals, though? I mean, they must be feeling a little bit distraught in all of this, and Andrew Hastie also a little nervous because he holds a seat which takes in this Sacred Harbour locality.
Yeah, good question. I think this was quite a disappointing result for the Liberals. And when you think about it, it's because in a by-election, if you're running a protest vote against the government, wouldn't the opposition normally pick up some votes? You would expect that they do pretty well in those sort of circumstances. But despite a 22% swing against Labor, Liberals also copped a 7.76% swing against them. So they really not only did they make no headway, they went backwards in this election. So people are not happy with the government, not happy with Labor, but they didn't want to vote for the Liberals. So that should concern people in the Liberal Party because they desperately need to build numbers and seats at the next election. And there are two ways to look at this. Basil Zemple has put on a very brave face and said, a win for One Nation is a blow for Labor and it's good. But Andrew Hastie was much more sober. And I think I'm aligned a bit better with his analysis, where he says, you run to win. So anytime you run and you don't expect, you openly don't expect to win, that's not a good thing. And the One Nation threat is quite significant for our party and we've got to take it on head on. So 72% of the Secret Harbour electorate is in his federal electorate of Canning. So he's probably right in the firing line for One Nation federally.
It raises the question which gets raised sort of weekly, if not daily, over the last 12 months at least, whether the Liberal Party is in terminal decline. And I'm not just talking nationally, but everywhere. I mean, what you've just said about Basil Zemplis' leadership in this period surprised me, I have to say. Why wouldn't they have just gone out and fought instead of hoisting the white flag?
I think either they should have not run if they didn't think they could win and if they thought there was a big orange wave coming, or if they run, you run to win and you make that messaging really clear. You might recall our listeners, the 2022 election, where 2021 election, I should say, where Liberals openly conceded they couldn't win the general election in WA. And I think that just all that did is made people think they're running up the white flag and Labor did even better. So I don't think you go out and say you're happy finishing second or third. It's not the best messaging.
Well, Martin, we've had the Cook Labor government running around even after they just lost the election, announcing more infrastructure, more rail. They've just got a kickstart development of build to rent, nearly 100 apartments in Mandurah, just down the road from Secret Harbour. Daniel Pastorelli was speaking up at Alkimos in the north of Perth about a big event. They're talking up what they're doing, the Fremantle Traffic Bridge, the new one will be opened in the next couple of months. They'll be spruiking what they're actually doing. They'll be talking about their policy detail. But when I look at the election success of One Nation here, and more generally, it comes back to what you were saying earlier. You've got these large sentiments. There's too many people coming into Australia. Migration is the issue. Everyone's going broke, and it seems to be sentiment politics is completely overtaking policy detail. Or am I wrong?
Yeah, I think that's part of the thing is when there's sentiments that are baked into how people feel, it gets very, very difficult to shift those. There's Roger Cook said that he's going to be focusing more and more on the cost of living and basic household issues. But actually, that's been a key focus for the government for some time now. Their entire budget in May this year was predicated on that. And now it's a few handouts here and there. Remember the $100 payment, Michael, and other things, free transport on Sundays. And there's been a lot of effort and energy put into housing development, etc. So they're already on this track, yet it didn't arrest the One Nation vote in Secret Harbour. So I think there's still some more work to do around that that they haven't quite worked out.
Well, not just an existing state Labor government or Labor more generally or the other political parties. You've got people saying you have to take it up to One Nation. Andrew Hastie's been saying that as well. I mean, how do the parties seek politically? What does history, what does political science tell us one needs to do?
So negative campaigning has worked against One Nation before, which is why I think Albanese and the ministers have gone on the attack. You've probably seen that in the last couple of days. If we switch our minds right back 30 years, 30 odd years, to the first real coming of age of One Nation, you might recall, Michael, at the 1998 election where they did quite well and they carved out a big section of the coalition vote. John Howard and Tony Abbott went very hard against One Nation, and bagged them out at every opportunity and helped drive down their vote. Some cynics might say they adopted some of their policies along the same way at the same time, hand in hand. But nevertheless, that twin fold approach seemed to have worked. The other thing about One Nation is not that you just want to rely on this, but they do have a history of imploding when their MPs get to Parliament, and they do tend to leave the party. Even David Farley, who's been there for 2 nanoseconds in the Federal Parliament as the member for Farrer, is, there's talk about him leaving. So I think One Nation does have that history of instability as well.
It is interesting, the candidate I mentioned, Luke, coming in here, Hertogen, and he's only been in the electorate a short period of time. He seemed to be quite energetic, a younger bloke, and he beat the more experienced Labor candidate who we've mentioned, Georgia Trees. But I mean, how does that come about? Does it mean that the candidate doesn't really matter, or he seems presentable enough, and it's the bigger, wider issues?
I think your candidate becomes an issue if there's deep flaws in the candidate. There was a few things brought up about his past, but there's a few about most candidates, I think, in these scenarios, but nothing earth-shattering. The fact that he was a gym owner, he came across as pretty blue collar, that kind of guy, affable sort of guy. I think that probably didn't do him any harm, but he didn't speak a lot himself during that campaign. It wasn't like he was doing a lot of media events, etc. either. He did the right thing and was on all the pre-polling booth and that kind of stuff. But like I said earlier, I think while he was a presentable candidate, and I don't think the candidates, I mean, I thought the Liberal candidate was quite presentable as well. But I don't think the candidates were the big deciding factor this time around.
Well, I'm still trying to work out what this shock result, because it has to be said, even though you said it was expected and you predicted it, has to say about voter boredom, anti-establishment mood, the growing volatility of the outer metro WA seats, as you said, not to mention the implications of this for everyone around the country. I mean, are people just turning off politics? And if they have to vote, they vote for anyone. They vote for change. I mean, is there some other cultural thing happening, Martin, in our community? What are your master students telling you?
Well, the other thing I think that's interesting is we've never been in an age where information and facts have been more contested. So you could say they've always been contested, and there's always been political arguments and debate. But with social media and everything that's going on, there's never been a better ability to throw any old stuff out there into the public domain. And I think that's also confusing voters. I think they're getting a lot of different messaging, a lot of very polarized messaging. So if you digest, I don't know, if you digest conspiracy theories, Michael, you'll keep digesting more and more of them because the algorithm will feed them to you. So this is, this type of way that we're digesting the news is it is leading to more what we call fragmentation of political views. And I think that itself probably lends itself to the rise of different and new players in the political domain on both the left and the right.
Well, it looks like the latest Guardian Essential poll is mirroring your comments. The percentage first preference votes for the let's call them the major parties, Labor, the Coalition, and One Nation are going up and down. It looks like One Nation have actually dropped a few percentage points, but then again, so has Labor, who are pretty close to One Nation, and the Coalition seems to have picked up. Can you read much into all of this, or is it what happens in the
Well,
poll?
I think it's just that particular poll is just a jumping around a bit, and you wait and see how the numbers settle for a number of consistent polls. So the vote for One Nation has jumped around a little bit. The Labor vote has declined a little bit, but it's still around about the mid-20s. And the one it appears in a couple of recent polls, the coalition vote has climbed a little bit back to 20 or above, but off a very low base, Michael. The point that I would make just in response to that last thing that you said, which I think is really important, is there's about a 25-year slow decline in the primary votes of the major parties. 25 years this has been happening. Now, that's first manifested itself in the Senate because you get all these different, it's proportional voting. Now it's starting to manifest itself in the House of Representatives and in lower houses and other places like WA. So the As you're getting candidates who get 25, 30, 35% of the primary vote, they're starting to win seats. So it's not entirely new phenomenon like that. And that's used to be that if you were a Labor, you just had to get more votes than Liberal, pretty much, and vice versa. And now it's much more complex.
Well, let's finish on Cottesloe. You confidently said this really couldn't happen in a Cottesloe. And is that because, with all the analysis that you've made and the economic, social issues, that a Kate Chaney at a national level is going to continue to win an electorate that's got a Cottesloe in it because they have other things that appeal to the voting public, different from the major parties and not One Nation?
So, if you accept that more people are going away from the major parties, and if you accept that more people are frustrated with politics as usual, but if you also accept that the demographics of seats do vary across our country and in our state, then this explains why the Teals can do well in inner city areas and why One Nation can do well in other areas. Because people are still angry and frustrated, but what they're interested in change in enacting change for differs. One Nation does fairly poorly overall amongst people with high levels of formal education. So we're talking about university degrees and further. Conversely, the Teals do well in those demographics. So if you live in Cottesloe, Claremont, Churchlands, places like that, and Nedlands and Dalkeith, you may still be unhappy with how things are going, but a Kate Chaney is probably a bit more appealing to you than Lou Kurdjian.
Well, Martin, I'm most grateful that you've been able to find time this morning on a Wednesday to make this special edition of you from the Roundhouse. As we've said, and as we agree, I think that this was a big deal, this by-election. You predicted the outcome for all the reasons you've given. Are you prepared to suggest that it's all going to slow down, or do you think it's just going to be what we've currently got with a steady increase on the One Nation front around the country?
I think for now we're going to see more of the same. And I think Victoria will be a particular sort of bloodbath for Labor because that's a long-term and unpopular Labor government still. After that, it could get quite interesting. And it depends on a range of factors. So, does One Nation implode? Does its members start going off script? Is there lots of tawdry tales about One Nation MPs and the like? What happens globally? I think we'll probably see Donald Trump nobbled a bit at the midterms in the US, which will sort of make his agenda harder to pursue, etc. What's that mean for the global situation? And what happens in terms of our own economic framework? Do we see, do we continue to see a slow in the growth in the price of housing, for instance? So there's a lot of different economic and social and cultural factors that are going to unroll from the beginning of 27 onwards, I think in particular, that would tell us a fair bit.
Martin, thanks for joining me today. That's been really interesting. Thank you.
A pleasure.